And welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Bubba and the Bloom, episode 91. Going to do part two of our baseball HQ forecaster preview, meet some of the contributors to the wonderful baseball Bible, as I call it. And I'm not the only one that calls it that. But we'll have a couple guests on, but we won't have them together. We'll have them separate because they have two different niches of the group here. But first off, you can find me on Twitter at BDNTrick, the podcast at Bubba Bloom Pod, and my co-host, as always, on Twitter at Ryan BHQ Bloomfield. How we doing, my friend?
Long time no see. It's been all of like 12 hours since part one. Thanks again to Alan and Corbin yesterday for their contributions and their show. That was fun. Looking forward to today with Misters Blessing and Cruz. So doing well, man.
Yep, good. It'll be a blast. And you hinted at it there. So let's meet our first guest on the show. He is the Baseball HQ Director of Prospect Analysis. I've had him on Bench with Bubba before. He does amazing prospect work over there at Baseball HQ. You can find him on Twitter at C_Blessing. Chris Blessing, how you doing, my friend?
Doing well, man. Just got back from Arizona. I was telling you guys, was at the First Pitch hotel two nights ago. Missing all the First Pitch people. It was bizarre not being there when baseball's going on.
Were there any spare beer cans still lying around from First Pitch?
Or actually, no.
Bubba's High Noon still?
No, I stayed away from the podcast room because I know that was a dangerous place this year.
It'll never be the same, that room.
There's caution tape on the door probably still, and they're just going to call it good for now. Hazmat suits required. Yeah, that was a wild one this year. That's for sure. But let's get into some get to know Chris stuff here before we talk about the forecaster. So we know, but let's let the listeners know, how long have you been at HQ and what else do you do writing for HQ besides just the forecaster?
Started writing in 2009, started HQ in 2015, basically going to the ballpark, scouting a bunch of guys. It's what I've kind of done my whole time. I transitioned over to fantasy in 2014. I feel like I'm still, a little bit behind the eight ball because I do come from a scouting background. Most of the people in this genre that I'm in come from a fantasy background. So it's been interesting helping them out, and they've helped me out at the same time. I also write, I'm the associate editor of the Minor League Baseball Analyst, which has a huge deadline coming up this weekend. So very exciting, a lot of writing to do, probably starting tomorrow because I'm absolutely exhausted today and would not make sense. I also host the Eyes Have It podcast. Going to come back for, I think, fourth year. Brent Hershey, our boss, is the co-host, but he's actually going to scale back a little this year, and we're going to probably have him only once a month, and I'll have guests every other time, so it should be exciting. And then outside of HQ, Lindy's baseball preview, which will come out in next month. Look for it. I'm the guy that writes up the prospect article in that magazine.
Awesome.
That's a ton of stuff. The minor league baseball analyst, by the way, like I feel like it doesn't get as much pub as the forecaster. Hasn't obviously been around as long. It is a phenomenal book, phenomenal pairing with the forecaster. So that comes out what, mid-January usually?
Like towards the end of January is when it gets shipped. I mean, it's a great book, and you know, Derek McCamey was the first to start it. He's currently with the Cardinals. It's you know, survived all these years with very minor tweaks. I mean, it's been a great book. And it's been great to be a part of, especially the last couple years.
Most definitely. I know it's a good 1-2 punch, as Ryan said. I bet you it's getting more popular as Dynasty becomes more and more popular around the fantasy world, and not to mention some things we'll talk about in the show. A lot of young players getting some chances these days. So that is becoming more and more valuable.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff in the forecaster, and that kind of nails it too. Like the minor league baseball analyst is a lot more, obviously, it's totally prospect-based, and there's essays and things like that in there. And mega lists and things galore. There is, and to kind of pivot it to the forecaster, I feel like focuses more on next season, like for redraft leagues, at least on the prospect side. So a lot of the stuff, Chris, that you're doing, we do like a top, I think 75 prospects for 2024. And then we also, obviously, anybody who we think, and kind of behind the scenes, Ray Murphy and all of our playing time analysts do this in like late September, early October. Anybody who we think from a playing time standpoint that will be relevant in 2024, they get a box in the forecaster. And so a lot of times what that means is prospects. And yes, in previous years, this is a big change that happened this year in the forecaster. Was in previous years, myself, and again, yesterday we had Corbin Allen on, the box writers themselves, even if it was a prospect without any major league time, like a Jackson Churio, we would have their player boxes. And to me, admittedly, it was a little bit tough. We aren't prospect guys. We haven't seen these guys play in the majors, and we don't have the data in the boxes to be able to do that. So one of the changes that we made this year, and I thought it was a great change, was we outsourced that to Mr. Blessing. Yes. Anybody who, not just rookie eligible, like we covered some rookie eligible guys where there is a major league sample, but basically anyone that's 2024 relevant that does not have a major league track record, we did not write those this year. We the player box writers, we passed those over and handed it over to Chris. So Chris, the question for you is like, what was that transition like? This, I mean, that basically you are writing your player boxes for the first time. So how did that go?
It was first off an amazing opportunity when Brent presented that to me. I was ecstatic. Then I got to writing, and my first box.
I was ecstatic too, because we had less to do. It was
great. My first box was on Evan Carter, and I was, and I used Evan Carter kind of as the guy that, like, I learned how to write at that time. I think when I wrote his box, it was the ALCS, so it was into the World Series. So like I could get like now observations of him, while also like, you know, digging into it. And like with Carter has, obviously a lot of hype by him, with the profile right now, but like the dude can't hit left-handed pitching at all. I had one extra base hit through the whole minor league season and into the postseason, into the major leagues against left-handed pitching. So I picked him to start with because I thought it was a very interesting profile, especially considering the hype he was getting, especially after that really strong September. But, you know, the Rangers were smart, never really had him face left-handed pitching.
And anything, so in looking at Carter's box, but for any forecaster readers out there, anybody with the box at the end of the commentary, it says CB in initials. That means it was the fault of this guy. Yeah. Blame. Take your pitchforks and go to Blessing.
Don't blame the guy at the bottom of the page.
Yeah. Just one big change that we did behind the scenes this year that I think helps the coverage a lot. That Evan Carter fact is actually fascinating to me because he is getting taken pretty early in 2024 drafts with the expectation that he will have everyday playing time in Texas, and that those struggles against lefties, that's a nice little tidbit you threw in that box.
Well, thanks. Yeah,
I like that HQ did this year because with the rapid influx of call-ups last season, this is way more relevant than ever. Like now you might actually draft some of these guys potentially, or at least put them quickly on your radar for call-ups from FAB when we see them come up in the first few weeks potentially. And that makes it much more entertaining. So if it's in the forecaster per se, the prospect book that comes out later, there's at least it's on the radar already. Like, hey, these are what we're looking at, something to do. And to that point, Chris, in 2023, we saw a ton of call-ups. It was just insane. Usually in the past, it was like, you had your certain dates, your super two dates, all these different dates, and you get an influx here and an influx there, but not a whole lot throughout the season. It was like weekly. We had a new pitcher or a new hitter or multiple guys a week. Was that just a one-off thing, or is this what we expect going forward now that teams are trying to maybe save money or utilize players before they get hurt, or a lot of angles? So how do you see this going moving forward?
It's a loaded answer, and the reason why it's so loaded is we had all of this excess in the upper minors of guys that were kind of maybe held back a bit by the pandemic and stuff. So you had all of these guys plus all of these different rule changes that have taken place. So to answer part of the question, will we ever see it as great as 2023? Probably not. But is this also the new norm? Yes, at the same time. You're going to, you know, just given the incentives teams have now, specifically if you even also just look at August, how August was handled with prospects like Mason Wynn when they came up. You know, it gave them time where they still had prospect eligibility, meaning rookie eligibility. And, you know, let's say Wynn plays the whole year. I don't think so. I think there's still some work on that offensive game. But, like, you know, it makes guys more valuable to teams, especially since the age of players is trending down. Matt Eddy at Baseball America had a great article a few weeks ago on that. I mean, plus, I don't know if teams trust their player development guys. Let's rush these guys to the major leagues like the Angels are doing, and let our best coaches, and especially now with Ron Washington and with the Angels, you're going to probably see more guys get pushed so quickly into that organization's major league club.
I have a question on this also. As I've mentioned it to some other people, and it was just pure, you know, dumb speculation probably on my part, but for someone like yourself that kind of pays attention to this a lot more, it seemed like most, not all obviously, but most of the teams that were more aggressive were quote-unquote cheaper teams. Like you had the Guardians, you had the Reds, things like that, where at least it felt that way. Maybe they just had more influx available in the minors. Is that something we'll see as teams that are trying to save money? Because these guys are cheap, obviously. Like the players coming up aren't going to cost a lot of money unless you go Brewers and give Churio a deal to bring them up. For the most part, relatively cheap, non-arb years even, stuff like that. Do you think those teams might, like, I guess what I'm saying, so come draft day, should we be more comfortable maybe taking a chance on the cheaper teams, or is it just kind of a case, like a weird situation?
Well, it's kind of weird. So if you look at like the Dodgers are still taking their development the same way that they always have. You saw a guy like Dalton rushing in high A last year, not get up to double A. Like they're still very specific focus. But then you had teams like all of a sudden the Rays, you know, the Rays tended to hold their guys back in the minor leagues. And then we see Junior Caminero just jump from high A, you know, all the way to the major leagues. You know, I got to see him twice last year, and then he's in the major leagues, and it's crazy because I don't even cover triple A where I'm at. So, so you're seeing that. But like a team that is this offseason showing a willingness to spend money, to absorb money, the Braves, they've had no problems the last several years bringing these guys up quickly. So it all depends upon the depth of a system. Obviously, the Reds didn't, their strength was in the upper minors, so they could, you know, get those guys up there. Now you look at the Reds organization writing them up, and there's a couple pitchers that are still prospects, but most of the guys in the minor leagues hitting wise are probably not coming up this year.
Gotcha.
One of the, I guess, side effects of what we saw last year in early drafts, and Bubba and I are crazy enough to be have multiple drafts in our rear view at this point, which is kind of sick. It's December 13th.
Speak for yourself.
But I judge myself all the time. Don't worry about it. Wyatt Langford. So there are guys who have zero MLB experience who are being drafted like early. Wyatt Langford, and I want to get your thoughts on some of these guys. Wyatt Langford is going, for example,
like 140-ish.
Yeah, he's going in December, like draft champions on the NFBC around like 140, 150, around someone like somebody safe, like Ian Happ, who's actually going right around there. So like you have a safe, and I'm just throwing out Ian Happ as kind of the anti Langford, where you kind of know what you're getting. You're maybe getting 15-15, like a 260 batting average, and someone who's going to play every day, versus what are you getting with Wyatt Langford? So these, like in Langford's case in particular, is someone like him worth a top 10 round pick with zero MLB experience?
Somebody like Jackson Churio, maybe. I just don't know if Langford's that guy. I recently took him in a prospect draft, 1-1, but like it was a prospect draft. Like it wasn't, full on, player pool and that sort of thing. I think a lot of that is how he performed after coming from Florida. He basically accelerated really quickly to, I think he ended up in AA. He might have ended up in AAA. I kind of lost count at some point. But the thing is like, I think his biggest value is seeing if he can play center field for the major league club. We're not talking about fantasy. And I think that there's big question marks whether he handles center field. When I did my Lindy's list, which is non-fantasy, I ranked him, I think, third overall. I had Holiday 1, Chorio 2, and then I had him number 3. And I was in a scout section right after first pitch, scouting some college guys for an organization that kind of help out. And the scouts were quizzing me on my picks. And mind you, my area kind of encompasses the University of Florida as well. So, like, they were very curious why I had him 3, because they didn't necessarily have him 3 as, you know, coming out of the draft. Like, they are, you know, third best prospect. They had guys like Drew Cruz and Paul Skeens ahead of him in the draft. So it was kind of interesting, you know, talking about the improvements he made as a pro. But I think at the end of the day, like, I would be worried to take that guy in the 10th round or sooner, just because I don't believe that the Rangers have the plan to, you know, push him forward as quickly as people think they do.
That's music to my ears, honestly, because all I keep hearing and from people that I respect in the game, they're like all aboard that train. And that's pretty interesting stuff there. I don't know if Ryan had more Linkford, but that's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting to compare that him to Churio, who, and I don't know if this is a thing, and at least this could change in a month or so, but like Churio has signed his contract. Like, is that a fair assumption to think that Churio, now that the contract is signed and he's locked in, that he'll be on the opening day roster for Milwaukee?
I mean, I'm going to, you know, just for the draft compensation, if he were to win, like, you know, rookie of the year or finish runner up, I think of course you have him on your opening day roster. He was a kid that struggled at the beginning of last season. And most of that, for your listeners, I know not everybody's in the whole prospect thing. His struggles happened because it seemed to coincide, I should say, with the sticky stuff that they were testing in AA. So like all of his struggles early were related to him basically bailing out on pitches because these sliders were all of a sudden like just awesome, you know? And then once the sticky stuff stopped getting tested, he went on this enormous tear. And so like, you know, seeing something like that and seeing him adjust to, like, I don't have a fear for him going up to the big leagues to start the year as I would with Langford, who never really had a chance to struggle in the minor leagues. You need to struggle. You know, I guess you don't need to. And people, I'd rather a guy struggle and figure out how to work through that in the minor leagues, like Chorio did last year, compared to somebody who has found things easy. And, you know, guys can get hit, you know, hot, and it doesn't really matter what the, you know, level they're at. So sometimes that kind of carries the whole performance. But like as a prospect, Langford is right there, you know, maybe the third guy of, you know, the top guys in the prospect thing. But like for fantasy, for guys who haven't performed this so far, like I have Chorio higher, and I would even say I have a Holiday who might not be up at the beginning of the year, but I have Holiday like a better producer next year, 2024, as opposed to Langford.
This is fun. I'm liking this now. Yeah, Churio's going as high as 124 since he's basically got the contract. So yeah, people are buying into that one for sure. But the Jackson one's going to be interesting to watch that ADP fluctuate, because you know, they came out and said if he has a good spring, basically he will start with the team. Like they want him to start with the team. Mm-hmm. Of course, they want to say that too. Like, get the kid motivated. That makes a ton of sense. But it's the same thing. Like you said, the incentives teams have now, if he's ready and he could potentially win a rookie of the year, yeah, you're coming up, kid. Like we're doing this thing. Yeah. So it makes a ton of sense. I do have one other prospect that wasn't on the list here, but just dawned on me because you mentioned him earlier. Do you have any quick thoughts on Caminero of the Rays? Because when I'm in a draft room and I see that name, I just get like, what are the Rays going to do?
Well, it seems like they're all right. So in their system, it's their scouts actually go and watch their players or whatever they call them. They all have different names, player acquisition, whatever kind of specialists. I don't know what their names are. But like you always see their personnel watching their players, whether it's player development or scouting. The wows that you got from him from their own staff last year was pretty amazing just to hear that, like, oh my God, can you believe that guy just hit the ball out? Like, I saw him hit a ball the opposite field in a place where loft is just suppressed, and was able to like somehow hit it further than any left-handed hitter I ever had seen at that stadium, that specific stadium. Maybe Jason Hayward back when he was a prospect might have been better, might have been able to do that, but like not many guys have been able to do that. I think that they're willing to have him as a full-time player just because of his approach and his ability to, and when I say approach, I mean ability to like spray liners to the opposite field and also, get to left field. He is a little aggressive, so they might want to, calm that down a bit. And maybe they only give him, part-time playing time in successful, matchups, lefties, righties that aren't necessarily hard throwers, high spin right type guys you maybe try to avoid. But it's always hard to predict the Rays, obviously. It's almost impossible.
It was interesting that the Rays, Cameron Arroyo got playing time in the playoffs and was hitting like second or third last couple weeks of the season, which not only did he get called up, but he was like a key cog. Enough of these high-profile prospects. Bubba and I's draft champions draft is now rounding into the 24th round, and we need some more under-the-radar prospects that you may have written up in the forecaster this year. Who are some of those guys like that aren't your high-profile or highest-profile guys for 2024 that aren't going in these top 20 rounds or whatever? Any 2024 redraft like under the radar guys that you're looking at that you're high on for 2024 only?
It's always looking for playing time, obviously.
Yeah.
And where there's a playing time opportunity. The first two were kind of easy. I picked three guys. The third guy was a little more difficult because the third guy I was going to pick was Mauricio, the Mets. But then Mauricio, the Mets got hurt and is,
Sucks.
Yeah. Yep. So, I'm not a big Mauricio fan or anything, but like there was a path to playing time and all of that stuff. Number one on the list is Xavier Edwards from the Marlins organization, former Rays prospect, former Padres prospect. He's kind of bounced around a little. I think what makes him valuable is his contact skills, his ability to get on base, and when he gets on base, steal bases. There's some issues with I like his bat better from the right side than the left side. And I've always liked it. Got to see him, I think, 2019 play in high school and, kind of had the same feelings then that I have now about him. The second guy is another guy that I saw in high school, I think in 2018, maybe 2019, Parker Meadows, brother of Austin. Parker is not a good hitter. But see, the thing is, what he does really well is he fields and that carries you to center field at bats. And so then he also can hit for power and he's a fast guy.
He runs. Yep.
So like we're talking about sleepers here. This guy kind of fits the mold. And actually with one of my fantasy teams, one of my dynasty teams, we were talking about this. We actually acquired him, Brad Johnson and I, in the Devil Rejects League this week, just because there's that chance for some counting stats there and maybe get some batting average other places. And then the final guy I picked, playing time wise, I think that the organization is, and we're talking about the Red Sox, I think that their depth isn't that great. And that's Sadin Rafaela, who's outfielder, speedy guy, very aggressive hitter. And that's where some of the issues come. Obviously not going to be pushed up in drafts because there's a good chance that he racks up low BAs because of some swing and misses and that sort of thing. But like so far, like he seemed to have handled himself okay last year. But the, you know, the speed element and the, and he's a strong guy for his size and will pop a home run here and there too. So like, you know, there's some value there as well.
I'm a big Rafaela fan, and I get worried when they start making trades or signing guys. The O'Neill trade kind of concerned me a bit, but I still think Rafaela's talent should play out. We'll see. Like you sound like you, I like the talent as well. So that'll be fun. But I'm going to erase that whole last section there because
it's fine.
Yeah, I don't want people to draft Parker Meadows or Sedan Rafaela, so that's not going to go for air. Any other thoughts on that, Ryan? Before we get to a listener question from our buddy.
Why did Boston have to trade for Tyler O'Neill?
Somebody had.
Someone had to.
He was free. all right, from our buddy Colin My Shot, formerly known as Little Book of Calm, would like to know, Chris, when prospects who have no MLB experience get called up and it's time for Sunday Fab in redraft leagues, what are some of the best numbers to look at to help me decide who is worth paying up for? Stats themselves, but also stuff like age, level, prospect ranks, etc. Like, what do you look at when you decide, is this player worth going for?
Maybe the wrong person to ask that question. I rely very heavily on my scouting acumen because it's just what I am. First off, get a subscription to Baseball HQ. Check out the call-ups column.
There you go.
That is a very good to great resource for this because we take from our own analysis. We have a great write-up team for call-ups. I'm going to miss somebody, so I'm not going to name any of them, but they're great. So that would be my first thing is go there. I also like to look at things specifically contact rates. We use CT of you know, anybody that's hitting the ball, 80%, making contact at 70-80% on a CT stat is a guy that I'm interested in. Speed doesn't translate as easily. That's something that like you try to grab steals, even with the shorter, lengths between the bases at this point with the bigger bases, you're still, there's a big transition from there. The guy's fast, he's fast. But if you're hearing a guy it has average to above average speed or less than that, and he's stealing bases, has 20 stolen bases, you don't count on that. Power in AAA is illusion. All the bad balls that get rejected by major leagues go down there. So, and then of course Pacific Coast League is terrible too. Yeah, if the pitchers are surviving in those leagues, that might be somebody to look at. Reese Olson was a guy last year, that kind of stuck out for me as somebody that I picked up in many leagues because he seemed to be surviving, even though the ERA wasn't that great in AAA, those sort of things. You look for those secondary stats, to really kind of tell the story, but on base percentage, contact rate, and the number of walks is always good too. How many walks they have, if it's real, the automated strike zone also throws so much into that as well. It's becoming harder and harder, and actually is one of the two articles I'm working on for the MLBA this year is basically how do we make sense of AAA or AA when it's experiment after experiment after experiment. So like look for that in the minor league baseball analysts. Also I'm covering our first question about the call-ups and stuff. We're going to cover that as well in that book too.
Well, I can't wait. Bloomfield, anything else for Mr. Blessing before we wrap this segment up?
No, just to add on to it. So I joke about the the company man comment, but I do write. So I write the Fab column for HQ every Sunday. Yep. And when a prospect gets called up, I'm basically every single time I link to the org report for that player because there's nothing that I can add from a skill standpoint or to what Chris was talking about, scouting a stat line with so much noise at every single level of the minors. I basically add my commentary on what the short-term playing time outlook is. And I say for the actual scouting report and the skills, here was his prospect rating, and here's a link to that scouting report. I think that combination of the scouting plus the short-term playing time outlook is, you know, about the best we can do in terms of like new call-ups for Fab throughout the year.
Like our buddies at Rates and Barrels, they had Kyle Manzardo on, the Guardians prospect, talking about the automated strike zone and how he just stopped, you know, swinging at the high pitch that he couldn't hit. Like, and he knew that was like a bad thing, and that was what he was working on in the AFL, you know, trying to hit that pitch. But like, they were giving it to him for free. Like, they were telling him, okay, you don't have to swing at this because the way the strike zone is. So how do you evaluate somebody off of stats like Manzardo when he's basically telling you on, which I don't know, he might get in trouble for saying that, but like, it's true. Like, you know, I'll repeat it because he said it. Like, he was laying off the high strike because he knew it wasn't going to get called.
Yep, that's interesting stuff. Hopefully we have more players kind of getting their voice out there. And there's more major leaguers going on shows and having their own shows and talking. Maybe we'll get some more minor leaguers in somewhere, some way in the coming years to kind of talk. But minor leaguers might be a little more hush-hush, kind of like you mentioned, Chris, because they want to get that job in the bigs. Yeah. So they might not say so much. But make sure everybody you follow Chris on Twitter at @C_blessing. We look forward to the MLB A coming out in about a month or so, a month and a half, and everything else to come. But Chris, thanks for joining us, man. Always a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you for having me. Bear down.
Yeah.
Correct. 100%. 100%. Go get some sleep, man.
I will. Take care.
Okay. Have a good one, my friend.
Bye.
All right, now part two episode of the Baseball HQ Forecaster. We are joined by an editor, a very big time editor for Baseball HQ, an associate editor, someone that has the luxury of saying they were the ones that edited the Golden Child's work before he was promoted to the junior executive.
Oh, geez. I knew this was coming.
When I heard this individual was joining our show. This is the tame introduction. I thought of so many fun things I could say with this one. This is what friends do. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation over the next half hour. So you can find him on Twitter at BP Cruz. Brandon Cruz, thanks for joining us, my friend.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a full circle moment for me. It was the, 2014 maybe forecast or something around that.
Yeah, it was
that year. Yeah, when it was my first year on the forecast, writing player boxes, and Brandon was my editor. And I'll always remember the first. I want to say Evan Carter, because that's just who Blessing was talking about. Who was the Astros slugger? Carter.
Chris Carter.
Chris Carter. Yeah. That was my first ever player box, was Chris Carter for Houston. And I remember writing that first page, sending it into Brandon for his first kind of crack at edits. And I remember getting the email back, and Brandon, you prefaced it. You were like, yeah, this is, you're nice about it. First time, Russ, and you know, I have some feedback for you. And then the email was like, boom, like a list of not just for Carter, but for every single of those seven guys on that page. So it's just funny to think back on that. My first ever page, and Brandon was there to usher me along and eventually get me back on the rails, I guess.
Well, and I went back into my email archives and looked for those first pages that we worked on together. And yes, you're right. That first page, I did have notes on all seven players. Then I looked by the third page that you sent me, the third batter page. I said, you're writing like a forecaster vet, and it really seems like you found your voice. So I think that you picked it up really quickly.
I remember that one as well. So let's focus on that one, not the.
All I hear is that first one, and it was pretty crazy.
The first one was pretty terrible.
But I'm kidding. But one thing I'll say is, I'm not going to speak for Ryan, but for someone that I started writing more often in the last few years or so, I kind of doubt. I'm more of a podcaster, of course. And I remember my very first article with HQ, Brent edited my daily matchup. I got a similar email. And obviously you guys say it very nicely, but it was when I was like, okay, you need to do this differently. You need to do this different, like just like kind of a list of things. And it, the reason I want to bring it up is for anybody that's out there writing now or looking to write, it's never meant to be a mean thing. It's just to make things better. And honestly, if you get an editor that gives you feedback like that, you'll be better off in the long run. Cause some people kind of like, you know, pussyfoot around it and like, oh yeah, this is good. No, just give me the cold hard truth and we're going to be a lot better in the future. So I just wanted to throw that out there. It's like, it's fun. It's tongue in cheek. It's like, yeah, you got your editorial lashing, but it's kind of comes with the course. It comes with the territory. So it's pretty fun stuff.
Well, and I was fortunate enough to have Rod Truesdell as my editor when I started at the Forecaster, and he was great. I mean, he did a really good job of like pointing out all the things that all the mistakes I was making, pointing out ways to do things better, making suggestions, offering some encouragement. So I try to do that as well, but it is at the same time you're getting back to this to each writer with a long list of things that you want them to address. So it does sometimes, it can be a bit much.
I didn't realize Rod was your first editor. That's pretty cool. Cause he still writes, he goes back and forth. He works with, I think, Nick Rand.
Yeah.
And they kind of edit each other's stuff and they've been doing it
for so long. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Not really editing, it's more just give me a second set of eyes situation.
I think so.
Yeah. Well, before we get deep into this, and I'm really looking forward to it because yesterday we had Alan on and he said he's been, you know, reading the Forecaster and doing stuff forever, it seems like. And so it's fun to get kind of another voice that's been there for a while. So let's just start with it. How long have you been with Baseball HQ and writing for the Forecaster?
Well, so I started with HQ in 2005, and I was hired as a writer for what was back then called Market Watch, which was kind of a combination of Playing Time Today and Fact Flukes. So you would get five players, but rather than picking them out yourself, they would be guys who were in the news that week. So it might be in the offseason, it might be five guys who had just signed contracts. And I remember the very first player I wrote up was Chris Benson, the pitcher, if you remember him. Yeah.
Yep. For Pirates. Yep.
And I think this was when he was with the Orioles after that. Yeah. And so after that, I've been like a utility player for HQ over the years. I've done the batting average buyer's guide. I've done Playing Time Tomorrow, matchups, Facts Flukes. I've done some editing for the site. I did some spots for HQ Radio back in the day, some research back in the day, before, you know, we got people who are actually good at doing the research stuff. And then for the last, I don't know, like 6-7 years, I've been writing the First Impressions column, which is basically, it's under the Facts Flukes umbrella, and it's like a Facts Flukes column, except just exclusively devoted to rookie players and analyzing them. And I heard some of your conversation with Chris there at the end, and I want to really highly recommend the scouting reports on the HQ site, because those are invaluable for me when I'm writing the First Impressions column. I'm reading those every time for every player, because I want to see what they had to say and see how the things they said about that player, are we seeing those show up in the majors, in their first crack at the majors?
Nice, nice.
Yep, highly recommend. I think that comes out every Sunday as well, right?
Yep, that's a Sunday column.
Yep. Good one. To pivot back to the Forecaster. So, and we asked this last night to Corbin and Alan as well, who have, like Bubba was saying, who have been writing, but not quite as long, Brandon, as you. Want to get your thoughts on your player box writing process. We'll get to the editing part in a little bit, but like, you get this blank white screen of Excel with a bunch of stats inside a box, and you need to fill that white screen with the commentary that eventually will be on the book. What's your kind of checklist? What are you looking at before you even write the player commentary? And then, you know, what stats are you looking at or using when you're actually going through and writing the box itself?
Yeah. So, I mean, the very first thing I like to do is just start with the box and kind of let my eyes wander through the box and see what stands out, what grabs my attention. And basically, you know, I feel like I'm looking for a way in to talk about that player, anything that's going to give me a kind of a starting point. And so maybe from that, I'll get an opening sentence that I can write down, and, or I'll get an idea for something to dig into a little further. Maybe like there's something in, you know, a hitter's contact rate or the trends in their power skills. So I'm just kind of looking for that first little thing to grab onto. And I always, I kind of try to approach it from the mindset that I'm kind of a tour guide for the reader, that I'm trying to lead you through the box and point out what's worth noting. And, you know, say like, okay, look at this contact trend. Look at the gap here between his PX and his XPX, or look at the gap for this pitcher, you know, between their ERA and their expected ERA. So if I can kind of, you know, make it a little quicker for you to find the highlights of the box, that's, I feel like that's kind of our job as writers.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense, because I know, especially for like newer readers of the Forecaster, and yes, we have the Encyclopedia and Fanalytics and all that stuff that leading up to the player box section. It is, if you're newer to it, even if you've been reading the Forecaster for 5 years, and sometimes we do change some of the stuff in the box. I kind of think of that way too. It's like, here's what you're seeing and here's why it matters, for the last year or going forward. Pivoting a little bit to the editing side.
Okay.
I'm curious your thought, because I had to make this transition, I don't know, whenever I became an editor 4 or 5 years ago. What's the one thing that I always look at is there's kind of two parts to a Forecaster box, is like the analysis itself, and then this other thing that we call the Forecaster voice.
Yes.
When you first get a submission to you as an editor, are you focusing on one or the other, both? What's your editing process, other than telling me here's the laundry list of things that I did? What is that editing process? How's that different from the writing process, and how do you approach kind of that first pass of submissions?
It is a different approach, and it's you're kind of looking at everything. I mean, it's so many different things, because you are like you said, you're trying to make sure that the analysis is accurate, that it's is the process sound, are the points that the writer is making being supported by what you see there in the box? That's a big one. The things like the Forecaster voice, does it match the style that we're aiming for? Is it written tightly, which is super important, because those boxes are very small, though not as small as they used to be. They used to be about 35 to 40 words, which
I
joked at 55.
These boxes now look like,
oh, they're spacious
mansions.
Yeah, they're roomy.
They are.
Brandon logs in now. Back to your blank question, Brandon goes, this is easy. What are you guys talking about?
But I do feel like with these boxes, there's no one right answer that we're looking for. It's about interpretations of the data. And so, as long as, I think if you gave the same player to, five different writers, we'd all have five different takes on them. They might, you know, not be that far off from each other, but I don't think they'd be exactly the same either. So it's really just about making sure, again, that process is sound, that the points are supported, and then just the little things like, you know, typos, grammar, making sure the writer put in notes on the projection, which is an important part of the process. Each writer is asked to look at that initial projection and say, okay, I think you can make adjustments here, maybe a little more playing time, maybe a few more home runs, whatever, you know, they feel like is supported again by the data. You got to kind of just check every little thing. Like sometimes something as small as like platoon splits and quoting a platoon split, those can get dicey because they have small sample sizes. So you want to check those and make sure that the writer didn't cite like, okay, this guy was, had a great OPS plus against left-handed pitchers, but it was only 20 plate appearances.
Yeah. Yep. Those are common gotchas, because a lot of times in the player box, and what we do is we combine everything into 1 year, one row. So if somebody, and some of the stats are major league only, like some of the Statcast stuff.
Yeah.
And so you'll see a row where like this player had 550 plate appearances, but 450 of them were in the minors. And thus, can you really use X home run, XPX, which are major league only stats. So those are, that's a common gotcha. You made a really good point about sending the same box to five different people and getting five different things back. Because one thing I don't want to say I struggle with, but sometimes me and a writer may disagree on the outlook of a play. Like maybe I'm higher on somebody than the writer is, or maybe I'm lower on somebody than the writer is. Who's to say who's right or wrong? But I feel like as long as the data in the box supports the argument that, you know, that's what we go with. I wonder, Brandon, how do you, and this is more just an editing process in general, how much do you like lead the horse to water, or how much do you kind of say, I would suggest changing something to and leaving it open-ended and giving the writer kind of that freedom to grow, to learn and to edit that way, as opposed to, oh, I think you should say this. That's something as an editor that I always kind of struggle with.
It's hard. I think it really is kind of a case by case basis. It depends on how many drafts are you into this page with the writer.
Yeah.
Where are we in the process? Like, are we, you know, pushing up against the deadline for being done with hitters and we need to get this page moving along and up to Brent and to Ray and to Ron? So, you know, in that case, I may make suggestions a little sooner than I might otherwise. If I see a sentence that like I get what the writer is going for, but it's not quite there style wise, forecaster voice wise, I might suggest just give them a polish and say, if you like this, use it. If you don't, you know, take your own version of it. But the ideal scenario is to get each writer to a point where they are really comfortable with the process, with working with all the skills and, you know, getting to that place on their own. That's the ultimate goal, I think. I had a point, but I forgot it.
It's a lot editing. I can already, like, this is why I stick to podcasting more often than not. there's a lot to it. Yeah. And like, I have a face for radio, somehow YouTube involves, I don't know, but we're going to talk about players now. Cause you kind of mentioned, you know, obviously you're doing player boxes and that's kind of the fun of a lot of this. And everyone, you know, they say get their PDF or when you get your book, who's the first name you look at and all these kind of things. So now we're going to talk about some of the boxes you did. And just more like your favorites, least favorites, so on and so forth. So let's start with the positive here. Who is your favorite box that you took part in this season?
Well, so I always enjoy when there's an opportunity to have a little fun with the box. And I know you guys, I listened to your conversation with Alan and you guys talked about like, it's usually that backup catchers, middle relievers, guys that don't really have a lot of fantasy relevance. And so it's okay if you go a little off topic with it and have some fun with it. And so I was, one of my guys was Danny Jansen, who's not a backup catcher. He's more of a, you know, playing time split catcher, I guess you'd call him. But when I got to his box, I noticed that he had fractured his middle finger on September 1st. And I was like, middle finger. Yeah, I can do something with that. And so I just decided to, come up with as many different ways of, you know, saying, giving someone the finger that I could think of. I'm going over to Urban Dictionary and doing some searches there to remind myself. You wouldn't think that's how you'd be spending your time working on the forecast or going up and looking up, you know, euphemisms for giving the finger, but that's what I did for about 10, 15 minutes. And so ended up with doing like using that little running bit, but also giving you the analysis that I wanted to give you, which to me is like the perfect way to do it, where you can mix in some humor, but also still do the analysis.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was reading the box right now. It's beautiful. Like I said, when I talked on yesterday or the previous show with Alan, I'm a humorous guy. I'm a sarcastic guy. So if you can intertwine that kind of stuff, but still keep on point, I'm a big fan of that. Cause And we talked about it on the show, is there's over, what, 700 players, 800 players in this thing. Yeah. You need to mix it up. Like, oh, yeah, there's only so much dry, like, here's the stats you can do.
Yeah.
So when you can, like, flip through, you got, like, kind of the good analysis, normal. Oh, this is funny. Okay, now I got, like, rejuvenated to go read some more. Like, let's see where the next Easter egg is, basically. Yeah. What you just did there is, it's beautiful.
Well, that type of box, I kind of call it like a theme box, where you pick a theme and kind of stick with it as you go through. And I don't know who it is that first originated it, but it's been, everybody kind of uses that little format for fun once in a while, because it's just a nice way to do it. But yeah, I think it's really important to mix in some of the humor and things that keep it entertaining for the reader. It keeps it entertaining for us as writers, as editors. I mean, Chris Olson is really good at that. And so he's one of my writers. And so I enjoy getting his pages, because I know there's going to be something in there that's going to make me laugh. It's just a nice, I think that's something that Ron figured out pretty quickly when he first started doing the book, that it was necessary to have that in there to keep it from being too dry.
Yeah, for anybody that's been to FPAS, you hear Ron's opening, speech, and it's got all the notes, but there's always some jokes in there, and there's some humor and stuff like that. So it kind of falls into writing. And so you mentioned, like, you have Chris Olson and stuff. Do you ever read his and think that's good? Now I got to one up him in one of mine. Or
Absolutely. There's stuff that he sends me, and I'm like, I am so jealous that he thought of that.
Perfect.
Chris is one of the more humorous writers out there for the box. I always for the forecaster, I always kind of seek out his boxes. I like that talk of a theme of each box, because that's generally how I think of it too. I remember one year, is a tough one. It was like Nick Markakis. Like, what am I going to say about Nick Markakis? I compared him to like an old washing machine, and then I just did everything like about selling for spare parts, reliable, hasn't broken down, and all this stuff. So
if you can hit on something like that, it's gold. It's just, it makes it gives you structure, and it just gives you that little moment of fun and something different from, because so like I'd say like probably like 50% of the boxes were leading with either like an injury recap or talking about like, something that happened in between first half, second half performance. And so that's, those are necessary, but not necessarily as interesting for the reader. If the entire book was that way, it would be a little dry. And so getting to mix things up, having some variety is good.
What were some of your tougher boxes to write this year?
Well, for me, established star players are typically my least favorite to write about, just because I feel like there's only so much that you can find to talk about there. What am I going to tell you about Juan Soto that you don't already know? Unless there, something really surprising happened in the skills, there's not going to be anything earth shattering that I'm going to come up with in my commentary for you. Jose Ramirez is obviously one of those established star players. And as I was, looking at his box, one of the first things that stood out for me was that he lost $10 in rotisserie value last year, which, if you drafted him in the first round or, paid heavy auction amount for him, you were probably pretty disappointed in that. You look at his skills in the box, nothing really stood out as being a huge red flag. His power skills, like his XPX, has been around league average the last couple of years. But X home run was still pretty much in line with the home run output. The steal skills, the speed skills look pretty good. And so what then caught my eye as I was digging further was in the second half, he only had 28 RBI and 337 plate appearances. That was really, really low. And his overall total for the season was 80 RBI, which was down from 126 the year before. That's a huge loss of value in that one category. And RBI, I mean, they're always going to be a little unpredictable. It's dependent upon teammates getting on base for you. But as I was, once I saw that, I was like, okay, that's something I can use. And let me dig a little further on that. And so I found that he hit just a .147 with like a 517 OPS with runners in scoring position in the second half. That's one part of that really low RBI total. The other was that his teammates, only 92 of his 337 second half plate appearances were with runners in scoring position. And that's extremely low. I mean, both of those things are such outliers that you can feel pretty confident that that's not going to happen again. And so I feel like, you know, again, RBI are unpredictable. You can't say, oh, he's going to bounce back to 126 because that was probably on the high end of things, but he'll definitely, you feel pretty confident that he's going to do better than 80 next year.
And that's what I think. And you put that in the box, you put the literal sentence after you mentioned those, that slash line and the thing about his teammates is you say this shouldn't happen again, because it, while that is an interesting stat, the reader is probably wondering, okay, like, wow, that's crazy. The slash line and the teammate stuff. Is that sticky? Is that not? What does that mean for 2024? And I think by adding that part in, really helps kind of guide the reader from that aspect. So
yeah,
it makes sense.
Yeah. And at the end, I noted that, you know, his trends in his barrel rate and his XPX are, you know, they might be concerns as he's into his 30s now, but like none of it with an established star player like that, you really want to see something more meaningful in the data than that before you start saying, okay, you should be worried about this guy. So that just didn't seem to rise to that level.
And when you have Naylor hitting with him, he's going to be just fine this year. I'm not too worried about it.
Yeah. I was curious, since you guys have said you've been doing a lot of drafting, what are you seeing with him?
JRAM, he's going back into round one now.
Okay.
Yep, yeah. He's slipped. He's definitely slipped a bit from, he was pretty much consensus top five last year.
There was 2 years ago. I was like one or two, depending on if you wanted Trey Turner or JRAM. So
Which I'm still happy with. If you can get Ramirez in the back half of the first round, and we don't really, because we don't know ADP in the forecaster, we're not really concerned. We don't know the ADPs, and so we kind of we take that out, and we focus solely on the skills. But yeah, he slipped a little bit, and I think it's a fine buying up.
Oh yeah, yeah, I think so too.
So any other hard ones that? That you struggled with.
Year. So another one that, again, where I kind of had to do some digging outside the box was Hunter Green. So, you know, the first thing you see when you look at his box, he had a 482 ERA, a 142 whip, only 112 innings pitched. It was a pretty disappointing season. He had negative rotisserie value. And then you notice some really big splits between his first half and his second half. And he also went on the injured list on June 19th with a hip injury. And, you know, anytime you see an injury, I like to go over to RotoWire and look through their entries, because they have, you know, they kind of delineate it really in a great way where you can find them pretty quickly. But you can also go and maybe find some notes leading up to that injured list stint that may show you that things were happening prior to the transaction. And that was the case with him, where there was a June 4th entry. He had a start pushback because of hip stiffness. And at the time, David Bell, the Reds manager, said they had no major concern with the hip. 4 days later, another entry where Bell says Green's hip felt great. So, you know, and then 11 days later, he's on the injured list for 2 months. So it's kind of always wise to take those kind of comments with a grain of salt, because obviously I don't know if things just worsened that quickly, or if he was kind of not being fully honest with the info that they were giving out about Green at that point. But with that in mind, then I went back and looked at his first half, where he had a 393 ERA, a 396 expected ERA. And knowing that, you know, June was a little iffy because of the hip problem starting then, I wondered, like, okay, what would it look like if we remove June and just look at April and May? And that got me to a 354 expected ERA and skills that were very similar to what he did in 2022. And so that gave me the confidence to slap an upside label on him, saying that he could be in line for as being as good as having a 350 ERA and 225 strikeouts next year. And so that was a case where just doing that little bit more digging really helped.
I love it.
That, yeah, those upside, we don't just kind of slap those on guys we like. It has to be supported somehow. There's at least has to be like a flash or a sign of that skill.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, in Green's case, like the somewhat removing or just saying, what if the hip injury lingered and you know, in that April, May version, plus what we saw in 22 sticks around.
Yeah,
in the cards.
Yeah, since what I found was so similar to 2022, that added to my confidence level that, like, okay, this is what he can do if he's healthy and really on his game.
Question about that up label. They're obviously not on every player. How do you guys decide who gets up labels? But obviously you said they have to have like something that shows it, but how do you guys kind of differentiate all that?
Well, I think we're usually looking for a performance level that the player has never achieved before. That's a big one. You want to make sure, ideally, it should be a little bit above and beyond what the projection is. That's not always the case. Sometimes it will be a little closer to the present projection, but you want to see some separation there. And just, again, having something in the skills that really backs that up is important.
All right, well, that'll lead us to the next part here is, you know, you do all this research, you write all these player boxes and everything, and you're going to come away with some guys all of a sudden, you're like, wow, that was pretty interesting to see. I'm higher on this guy. Or there's the alternative where it's like, this guy was really bad. I knew what he was really bad, and we're just going to be really low on him now. So let's start with the positive on this one. Who are some of the guys that you are high on after completing your boxes?
Yeah, so talking about, you know, putting an upside label on someone, I did not expect to be slapping an upside label on Kyle Isbell. I had covered him for first impressions back in 2022. And I remembered kind of saying that he had a mix of power and speed that made him worth watching. Anytime I think you see a young player like that has speed skills and power skills that are above average, that's a good combo because, you know, you can get both home runs and steals out of that. So I said maybe that could lead to some value down the road. But that was, you know, again, I wrote him up in 2022. I hadn't really thought much about him since then. And so I was, you know, when I went in to look at his box, I was a little surprised at what I found there, especially in his second half. I mean, overall, he improved his contact rate, a really nice gain there into 80%, which is well above average. He improved his stolen base percentage, 88% on the season to 100% in the second half. So some what looks like skill improvement there. His XPX is up to 118. The league average there is 100. So some sign that the power skills are starting to come together. And in that second half, which was entirely in the majors, he had 202 plate appearances. He was worth $10. And that was pretty much in a platoon role because he just hasn't had enough success versus left-handers to break out of that platoon situation. And he's another example of needing to really take a closer look at those platoon split numbers, because in the box in the forecaster, you look at his OPS plus versus left-handers, and it's 120 in 2021, and last year it was 108. Well, the 2021 sample was 13 plate appearances in the majors, and the sample from last season, that was a 45% hit rate against left-handers. So both of those, it's the first one's a really small sample, the second one's just fluky. And so he's not as that may lead you to believe he's ready to face left-handers, but he's really not. And so he's likely going to be in a platoon role. You know, I said upside of 15 home runs, 15 steals, which is not huge, but could be worth something if, you know, depending on the size of your league. And the only other concern with him would just be that, you know, he's the type of hitter who could get pushed out of the lineup if the team acquires a better option. But it's the Royals, and It seems like they're probably not going to do that.
Yeah.
Kyle Isbell right now in these 50 round draft and hold leagues on the NFBC is going in the 41st round. So it's always cool to be able to find some of these like 30th, 40th round guys with upside tag. Like,
yeah.
And the Royals always had that. Michael A. Taylor was like the premium. He's going to get 15-15. He's going to be boring. You get him at the end of every 50-round draft. It's just that they're good at that. Bad teams have fantasy-relevant players. That's always a motto. Like, you can find them. You got to dig. You got to dig deep sometimes, or you can find them.
Yes.
That's for darn sure. The other player that you mentioned here, this is going to bring a lot of joy to Ryan's face. So who is this pitcher that you're much higher on now?
Yeah, so Braxton Garrett is another guy that I covered for First Impressions back in 2022, and I remembered, you know, seeing some things even then that I liked. That, and I wrote him up again for Facts Flukes in spring of 2023. So kind of had him, you know, in the back of my mind as a young arm with some potential upside. And so when I got to his box, I was coming at it from that perspective, from that mindset of looking for that. And there was some concerns, especially in the second half, some drop off in his performance. I went and looked, you know, at some of his pitch mix data, looking at the strikeout rates for individual pitches, just trying to see if, like, was it a new pitch that lost effectiveness, something like that. It was pretty consistent across the board. And so that made me feel like, okay, this is a still young pitcher. I mean, 25 this year, 26 next year, who, you know, surpassed his previous career high in innings pitched. And it seems like the most likely explanation for that second half drop off is just simple fatigue. And his, if you look at his skills from August and September, he had an 18% strikeout rate and an 8.5% swinging strikeout rate, both of which were way down from where he was in the first half. He was at 28% strikeout rate and a 13.2 swing strikeout rate. So it just all kind of seemed to track with that idea of it being fatigue related. And so I felt like, you know, that's not uncommon for a pitcher at his age and in his stage of development. And so I felt pretty confident giving him an upside label of a 3.15 ERA and 200 strikeouts for next year.
That's pretty sweet.
Quick follow-up on Garrett. Well, we mentioned this a lot. Or I believe Corbin mentioned this on our show last night, but we kind of have, it's not a hard and fast rule, but in general, we like to cite stats that are in the box, keep the reader's eyes in the box. And like you said, Brandon, kind of be the tour guide him through it. I bend that rule a little bit with pitch mix. And Corbin mentioned this last night where, no, we don't have pitch usage on these boxes, but I feel like where there is a change in skill and then there is that change in pitch mix to either support it or go along with it. I feel like that's, and I say that to my writers as well, I feel like that's pretty much always worth mentioning.
Yeah. I think it's use it sparingly. And just make sure it's a case where it really adds something
where it
to
matters.
The analysis. Yeah.
Yep. Agreed. Yeah. Well, as opposed to saying this guy has a slider, fastball, changeup. I mean, that doesn't, it's great for a scouting report, but for these boxes, we don't have the room to really, do it. So,
yeah. And sometimes, especially if like a pitcher has added a new pitch, that could really shine a nice light on what's in the box and kind of give you a new perspective on it that ties together really nicely. So it's, that can be a good option in certain cases.
All right. A little more negative side. So we talked about two guys that you, were higher on. Who did you look at now that you went through the process and that you're like, I don't know.
Yeah. So Harold Ramirez was one guy for me, that, you know, anytime you see a big gap between batting average and expected batting average, that for me is an easy red flag because we, you know, that's one of our oldest skills. We have so much, data on that being pretty dependable. And, you know, he's both in 2022 and 2023, he's got about a 40-50 point gap between his surface stat and his skill. And that's that's a little scary. You know, it if he were to lose all of those hits, that's going to have an effect on base percentage, on his runs scored, on his RBI total. And so, and then if you even you look at his platoon splits against left-handers, where he's had the last 2 years, his OPS plus was 122 and then 130. Even that was driven by a 43% hit rate, which you're going to expect that to come down to earth. And so just all of that combined makes him a pretty risky investment, especially when he's, you know, been earning double digit value the last 2 years. You look back at 2021 when he was with Cleveland, he hit 268 that year and was only worth $8. So, you know, you don't want to put yourself in a situation where you're picking up this guy thinking, oh, he's going to be great for, you know, a 300 plus batting average and double digit value again, and get the 2021 version instead.
And that was your downside label. So we just talked about slapping upside labels on guys, the UP at the end of a box. We also have the down, the DN.
You don't yeah.
those downs. And so, yeah, you threw the downside of that 2021 repeat for Harold Ramirez, which I could unfortunately see. The last guy that you've kind of written down here that you're lower on, I'm pretty very interested in this, because this guy's being drafted as a top five closer. And in the 2024 closer environment, that means you're spending a top 50 pick on Mr. Josh Hader. So, Brandon, what'd you see in Hader's box to kind of give you cold feet, probably at that price?
Yeah. I mean, and I want to put it in that context that I'm by no means say that you should avoid Josh Hader altogether. Just these are reasons to be a little concerned about him, maybe a little hesitant to spend, you know, big dollars on him. You know, he's a guy who's taken his fantasy managers for a bit of a roller coaster ride over the last three seasons. He had a 123 ERA in 2021, then 522 in 2022, then back to 128 last year. And so in cases like that, that's where it's really valuable to have expected ERA to look at. And when you look at that, you can see kind of a trend where he's been gradually declining. He was 254 in 2021, then 315, then 345. So 345 xERA, still pretty good. But it's more about that slide that we're seeing in that reflects, you know, some of the slide in his skills overall. I mean, we're seeing a similar trend in decline trend in his strikeouts minus walk percentage. We're seeing it in his BPX. And so when you see that those declines in a couple different areas like that, and especially as a player is entering his 30s, it's maybe not a red flag, but it's a yellow light, I guess you'd call it. Like, we're just a reason to be a little cautious when you're valuing that player.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. Like, that's one of my thoughts on Hader and others. And like, I'll do rankings and people go, why are you so low on so-and-so? I'm like, that's not personal. It's not against him. It's just like, you know, regression comes eventually. And there's a few signs and he still could be very good. He's just not what he used to be. Like, some people have a very difficult time. Like, I'll send Ryan, you know, pictures of comments I get on certain things, just like laughing, like, check this one out. This is fun. And it's it makes me laugh. So I understand exactly what you're talking about with Josh Hader, because I have similar concerns as well. So 100% there. Any final thoughts, Ryan, for Brandon before we wrap this up? It's been a pleasure getting to meet you and chat with you today. It's great to have the wisdom. And, you know, honestly, it's great to have someone that's put Ryan in his place and kind of put him where he is in this business. So it's been fun.
Funny guy, Bubba. No, this was an absolute treat. This was an absolute treat. So appreciate it, Brandon.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you guys having me on. It was fun to talk about the process and fun to talk about some players.
And last but not least, trivia question. I guess you know the answer, so it's not really a trivia question. But how long has it been since your last podcast episode?
So I was talking about this with Ryan last week, that I used to do, I think we called it the Metric Minute. For HQ Radio, where we would pick a skill and I would I've just recorded on my own. I'd give like the definition of the skill, the formula, talk about some examples, and then mention a few players from that season where it showed, like, if you're talking about expected batting average, someone whose the skills were better than the surface stats, another guy where the surface stats are above the skills, and then send it off to Patrick. So just a little minute recording. That was probably at least 12 years ago. So it's awesome. It's been a while.
12 years between pods. I think that might be record breaking.
Might be a record. Record for me, for sure. I guarantee you that much. So.
glad we could stop the streak. This was awesome, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, but thanks for joining us. And for those that don't know, he's on Twitter at BP Cruise, KRUSE. And Brandon, thanks for joining us, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan, we'll wrap it up there. Make sure y'all check out Ryan on Twitter at RyanBHQ, the podcast at Bubba Bloom Pod. I'm at B. Dientrich, and this wraps up our part two of the Baseball HQ Forecaster on Bubba the Bloom, episode 91. Catch y'all next time.